Aloha. Welcome to The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. I'm Catherine Cruz. Downtown by design. Today we explore what's possible as downtown Honolulu is at a crossroads. The pandemic emptied high-rises as office workers shifted to remote work. And then the chain stores abandoned the area with no critical mass to support their storefronts. What's next? We take a closer look at an invasive tree on Maui that's being targeted because of its fire risk. Ever heard of black wattle? And our Manu Minute highlights a rather modest honey creeper. Do you know your birds? Can you guess which one? Plus, a small business providing school lunches to Keiki feels the heat of federal policies, tariffs, and a grant cancellation have her worried about layoffs. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. The Waikiki Business Improvement District turns 25 this year. Former University of Hawaii Vice Chancellor and Urban Planning Professor Carl Kim had a hand in creating that model, and its success is being looked at as an option for downtown Honolulu. What has to happen to make downtown more inviting, cleaner, and safer for people who work, live, and play in the area? Well, the work of Kim's graduate students is being spotlighted at a downtown exhibit space in the old historic Liberty Bank building designed by Vladimir Osipov. It gives you a glimpse of what's possible for the future of downtown Honolulu, from the financial district to Chinatown and the budding arts district. Kim hails the effort as an opportunity to explore what's possible for a downtown where office space is making way for residential apartments and property owners are exploring an added tax, an assessment, to help reach that greater goal. But what worked in Waikiki may not fly in downtown.
That's part of the challenge. I mean, if this was an easy problem, I don't think we would have taken it on. And the idea, these are all graduate students who are very smart and energetic, and so we wanted to come up with a challenging problem. And it isn't just about copying or replicating exactly what was done in Waikiki. There was a lot of information and data that was collected and analyzed and then put together to generate both the scenarios, but also to come up with recommendations and the ways forward. And so part of what we were trying to do with this project is to get people to understand what the challenges are, to look at the analyses that have been done, and then see some of the potential outcomes of this. And so in addition to reports and presentations, each of the students was required to do a poster. And so there are about 20 posters altogether, which are on display showing, you know, the conditions that are there, showing some of the methods and tools that we use for the scenario planning, and then some of the alternatives. You know, planning is not just about knowledge to action. It's about generating alternatives and evaluating them. And so this is on display at Shade Institute, which is in Chinatown, until the end of the month. That Shade is located at 99 North King Street, which is the historic mid-century modern building designed by Vladimir Osipov.
The old Liberty Bank.
Yeah, the former Liberty Bank building, right in the district that we're examining.
So. Well, when you think of downtown, you think of the banks. Mm-hmm. You think of the downtown offices, and you have the residential component. And they're dealing with some of the same problems that Waikiki saw with homelessness and graffiti. And so how do you deal with the crime and all of that?
Right. Very, very important part. Of this safety and security issues, because if people don't feel safe, they're not going to want to come, live, and invest in that area. So that's a big component of this. But these are challenging problems, and they're related to a whole series of factors and conditions and actually even designs that affect these spaces. And so that's part of the challenging work to do. And a lot of that was captured in the scenarios and in terms of the work that the team members produced.
As you look at these hospital ideas. I mean, part of the challenge is the boundaries, right? Talk about how you map out who's in a particular district.
Well, I mean, initially what we did was, you know, data collection, looking at maps and then doing a lot of field studies. We used a lot of the principles that Kevin Lynch and other urban designers had to investigate the different attributes, the elements of city design. And then understanding that, what we tried to do was to study activity patterns, which are based upon land use and businesses. And it varies by time of day. You know, as Mickey was describing, it's very, very different in the different areas based upon, you know, the downtown arts district in Chinatown. And so part of the good work of the transportation group was to try to understand the movements of people, not just workers and visitors, but also residents and others that use this space, the peak and off-peak travel, the direction of travel, and then what could be done to improve not just the efficiency, but also the safety and security of the movements of people. You know, one of the things that we know is that activity also generates safety. I mean, this is, you know, what's been referred to as a broken windows theory, right? The more people that you have in a space, using a space, the safer that people feel. So, and some of that can be done through more activities. We've talked about the night markets and the street frontages and other types of design treatments that could be employed to create a greater sense of community, a greater sense of safety and cohesion.
Right, you want to create the buzz and draw people down there and get it thriving.
Right. Yeah. It's about the buzz, but it's also trying to understand what the underlying problems are and what can be done, you know, with limited resources, with challenges in terms of focusing the assets that we have to be able to improve the area.
It's a district by design.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And graduate student John Rolchek was part of a team that considered the history of the area.
Our team looked at what a business improvement district could do if it focused on historic and cultural resources within the area. So we did a survey of a lot of the historic buildings, both in downtown and Chinatown. Obviously, Chinatown has a very rich history as well to boot. We thought about what a business improvement district could do if it leveraged those resources and used it to create a stronger sense of place. So a business improvement district focusing on those values, it might provide very different types of services. One of the things I personally researched was a historic preservation designation. There's obviously economic rationale to that. If a property owner designates some other property as historic, they do get tax exemption benefits. Then we thought about how to lean into the public spaces that already exist in Chinatown and downtown. Some people might be aware that Waikiki now has a cap on public events. We spoke to some stakeholders who really believe that downtown and Chinatown could take some of that slack and start to host some of our public events. There's already a lot of public spaces that are underutilized or they're being misused. And we believe that certain kinds of key investments, we call them like a catalytic project, could be facilitated by a BID, a business improvement district, to then activate those spaces and connect some of these areas that already have a lot of rich history behind them.
I'm thinking of Ala Park, just because there's been a lot of focus recently about reactivating that area and trying to get people down there with their dogs, you know, a little dog park, that kind of thing, and then having cultural events to draw people down there. So it's that kind of thing.
Absolutely. Yeah, we looked at Ala Park and how it connects along Hotel Street all the way to the Capitol District and even to Thomas Square. That's a parade route that we investigated. But we also thought about, you know, if we leaned into Chinatown history and the urban history of downtown Honolulu, how we could have a gate, a new Chinatown gate that would attract visitors and tourists to take pictures with it and bring more people to gather in these public spaces. Could we do night markets? Could that be hosted or coordinated by a business improvement district? We have several ideas, even statues and wayfinding, which our transportation project also touched a lot on, is just if you can orient people to where they're going and where the points of interest are, is that going to be a nicer place for people to come visit?
Basically, how do you create magnets to make this work?
Exactly, right. Using what we already have, which is these really rich history that people just walk through every day, they don't give a second thought to, it could really create a stronger place for people to gather around and come to.
And Mickey Chacon is working on his doctorate in architecture. His team looked at the transportation piece of the district, since rail is soon to make its way through this area.
We treated the whole city center area, so Chinatown, downtown, Arts District, as like a terminal. You see these giant multimodal public transit terminals in Japan and other parts of Asia, where it's a mall, it's an entertainment venue, and it's public transit. So the two Skyline rail stations that are supposed to be in Chinatown, downtown, they're the closest stations to each other out of the whole line. And so we thought, well, the space isn't like the whole neighborhood, or the three neighborhoods are really compacted together. The two rail stations are really close to each other. Let's treat this whole thing like a terminal. The reason why we want to treat it like one terminal is that there's a lot of mom and pop businesses there that can benefit. There's people who might, because the transportation, we focus on wayfinding, so pedestrian wayfinding. So somebody might get off the station at Chinatown, even though they work at downtown, seeing how streamlined we made the navigation, seeing like updating people on bus leave and departures, train departures and arrivals, providing such a streamlined experience to walk between the different neighborhoods, because different neighborhoods are open at different times. And so downtown is like Richard to Bethel Street. It's open from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. It's mainly salary people and people who run the mom and shop lunch time places. And then there's Arts District, which kind of started in 2001, then reconsolidated into Downtown Arts Center. It's like Bethel to Smith Street. A lot of art galleries that are really only open Thursday through Saturdays. You know, there's the hotel street bars that are only open Thursday through Saturdays, Sunday if it's a three-day weekend. And, you know, open like at 7, you know. And then there's Chinatown, which is closes by 2 p.m. And that's late for a Chinatown businesses, you know, mainly lace shops, a lot of feng shui shops, and a few eateries there too, like, you know, Monica Marketplace.
And you spent time down there, so you know, so you've kind of felt the vibe.
Yeah, so I worked three jobs in all three neighborhoods. One summer, I was an architectural intern in downtown. And then I worked at art gallery because I'm also study museums and Arts District, and then I worked as a promoter for a club in Chinatown, so I was able to work all three jobs in one Friday, yeah.
And for many of us who go down in that area, we're not really cognizant of that, you know, the flow of the city, the downtown city.
Yeah, so people kind of talk about, like, why isn't there more people, like, why is no one going from downtown to Chinatown? Like, well, there's no reason to, because the people who are working, people who get off of work at downtown, Chinatown's already closed. You know, it's three different neighborhoods. It really is three different neighborhoods with different business hours, different office hours. Our project was trying to make it so that you can walk between the different neighborhoods at different times, kind of explore, generate a little bit more revenue for mom and pop shops. It's so close together. Everything's compact. It can really be like a terminal you see in like Shibuya Terminal in Tokyo. It could really be that. The foot traffic is the biggest thing. You got to streamline the foot traffic. Perfect case study of foot traffic, you know, cleaning up a neighborhood was in Philadelphia. There was Love Park, you had the statue with the love sign with the O's turned over a little bit. It became a really rough park. It has much poorly planned park. Not poorly designed. The architect who designed it knew that he designed it unintentionally for skateboarders. And when skateboarding became really popular, like street skateboarding became really popular in the 1990s, the whole place totally cleaned up. There's no drug dealers or anything like that, because there's too many people like playing on this weird popsicle stick, and it scared a lot of people away. And it was an extreme sport that was new at the time. It became a really cleaned up park. Like they would host events, like some of the X Games competitions were there, some different other competitions and demonstrations would happen there. The city didn't like that it was a new activity in a park not designed for it, but skateboarders are good post designers. So we take something and we make it into an obstacle for skateboarding and clean up the park, but they want to demolish it because it wasn't a part of the plan. And well, architects and planners used to be the same people. In ancient Greek, the word for design and the word for plan is the same word. And so the architect who designed the park all the way back then, he like skateboarded the park in his 90s to protest the demolition of it. And now it's just a boring park. It's like urban planners and architects, we have to work together, and we also have to let the community decide what it should be that we plan and design.
And Jacob Ruck and others walk the streets of Chinatown documenting what used to be Walmart, Long's, and Ross. What's next? And what to prepare for as his team looked at environmental risks as well as how to make the area more livable.
Our scenario looked at sustainability and we used the Clean City model. So we looked at power consumption, at sustainable technologies, as well as disaster mitigation and prevention tactics.
And what did you find in that downtown area? Is there any particular area that's more vulnerable?
We found that it's pretty much up to King Street with sea level rise. We ran different scenarios, and one of them was sea level rise under 6 feet. And the highest point went all the way up to King Street from, down to, that was the highest point. It wasn't exactly all of King Street, but that was as far as the highest point went during the sea level rise. And we also looked at urban heat, so the heat index and the improvement of that, and also ways of mitigating both of those.
And, we're all waiting for rail to come down there, but, I'm not sure when they planned that system, what they took into account.
That was more of the transportation, their section. We did, ours concentrated more on kind of the standing businesses already and things that could be implemented. The big one with the urban heat was that there are solar freestanding photovoltaic solar panels that actually track the sun like a flower would. And those can be used to generate shade on the sidewalks. So it's actually lowering the surface temperature and subsequently lowering the requirements for air conditioning. So it's like a win-win, and at the same time it's doing that, it's actually generating electricity. So having cooler sidewalks, especially in the summer months, people will be more likely to be down there, and as opposed to if it's just sun beating down on you, you don't want to go someplace. And we looked at other things of that nature. There's also the cool streets, I believe is the name of it's a type of paint that reflects solar radiation. So it, as opposed to the sidewalks absorbing the heat, it just bounces off. And they will actually use those to make designs. So those are things that could have, been tailored specific to an area. So like Chinatown or to, any other parts of the world.
And then these ideas are in use in other cities across the country.
Yes, that's correct. So we actually, the photos that we found were all functioning photos in different places. So some of them conceptually have been modified for our product, our project. But like in Saudi Arabia, they have these massive shade generators that can collapse, but they also have ones that generate solar electricity, and they shut down when it gets windy or so forth and are collapsible. So there was a lot of things that we were looking at, a concept that was used here, but we could use it as opposed to planting trees on the sidewalk. We could install those and instantly get shade and instantly start generating power. So. But that was what a lot of it was looking at what's out there and then looking at ways we can use it possibly in a different way.
Anything else you want to?
No, I think the project was good for all of us, and as far as learning to work on a team, as far as really kind of getting an understanding of what is out there when you're doing urban planning as a project for a client. And I felt that pretty much everybody came away from the practicum being able to go to a job and say, well, I've worked on one. This isn't new to me. I've done this before.
We have been hearing from University of Hawaii graduate students Jacob Ruck, Mickey Chacon, and Jake Ruchik, and their urban planning professor, Carl Kim. Kim is giving an update on the project to the Waikiki Business Improvement District organization today. The exhibit will be on display at the Shade Institute at the old Liberty Bank building through the end of the month, and the team welcomes your feedback. Look for links on our website later today.
Support for HPR comes from Noheya Gallery, presenting the 10-year reunion show of the former gallery at Ward Center, on view now in Kahala Mall. Updates on Instagram or online at noheyagallery.com.
Independent music programming goes beyond the expected and always with a human touch. HPR One brings you evenings and weekends filled with unexpected music discoveries. And HPR Two is Hawaii's only source for 24/7 classical music. Cuts to federal funding would impact our ability to bring you this solace during a time people need it most. Stand up for HPR and for public media. Visit hawaiipublicradio.org/protect.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Ulupono Initiative and Ruby Tuesday Hawaii.
Shift and save. Now, this is something I know a little something about because our household was one of many selected to take part in a pilot project to try and get families to use electricity in the daytime when demand on the system was low. Here to give us an update on that pilot project is HPR's Savannah Harriman-Pote, who covers energy issues for us. Good morning, Savannah.
Good morning, Catherine.
Yeah, I remember I had to fill out a survey to tell Hawaiian Electric what I thought.
Right. So you are one of many households on Hawaii Island and Oahu specifically who are kind of randomly enrolled in an experimental rate scheme last year called Shift and Save. People might also know it as Time of Use. And the important thing to know is it makes electricity cheaper to use during the day for residents, but more expensive in the evening and a little more expensive at night. And on paper, time of use is a win-win, right? Because customers can save money by changing their energy habits. And if enough of folks do that together, we can shift demand on the grid away from the evening and into the daytime when we have more solar resources. But Michelangelo, who heads the Division of Consumer Advocacy, says the data that we now have from that year-long time of use pilot program fails to conclusively demonstrate that either of those goals was achieved.
This was an important study to undertake, but there needs to be more. It's not as conclusive as we would have hoped in terms of whether the objectives of the program were achieved. The objective being whether customers under these rates would shift their energy usage from on-peak periods to middle of the day when it could be that energy could be served more directly by solar that is more plentiful during the day.
You know, I know my experience. I mean, I did change my habits, but it was a little tricky sometimes.
Yeah, and so what we know from the data is that we did see small conservation effects in the evening, but no statistically significant energy increases during the day. So that means people may have noticed that their electricity was more expensive in the evening and they used less of it, but they weren't truly shifting that energy use to the daytime, and those cheaper day rates were the main benefit of the program to participants. But the analysis shows that they just didn't work for some people. So the people whom they really didn't seem to work for were, one, people with rooftop solar. So people with rooftop solar who provide energy to the grid, the savings of this program might not have been commensurate with the income that they were already getting or the compensation that they were already getting for providing that energy to the grid. So a lot of folks who had rooftop solar unenrolled from this pilot program. The other group it didn't serve were people who worked during the day outside of the house, so they weren't home to do chores that were energy intensive, like laundry or washing the dishes. And commercial customers whose operation, again, doesn't allow them to shift their energy use, just didn't have that flexibility. So we did see a lot of folks opt out of the program. You could opt out at any time, and about a fifth of people who were enrolled in the program did choose to opt out at some point. And again, the majority of those were rooftop solar customers. I reached out to HECO and said, what do you think about this data? And they said results were mixed. Overall, Oahu households in the program saved some money, but Hawaii Island households saw higher bills. And Angelo doesn't see a compelling argument right now from the data that time of use is ready to be rolled out broadly to customers. But he doesn't think it should be rolled out entirely. He suggested that we could do more study on the real cost drivers in our energy system. So households and businesses that are using a lot of energy when it is most expensive. And then if we can identify those customers, HECO can create specific targeted interventions to get those folks to use energy in the daytime as rather than in the evening. So one example might be people with electric vehicles who charge their car when they come home from work.
An EV customer may be putting more load onto the system at night because they just don't have the opportunity to charge. And that's a substantial load, and we're going to have to plan around that. So we need to think about what the costs associated with that would be. Should they also receive some benefit of charging during the day if that delivers some benefit to the system?
Yeah, and I know, you know, we have an electric car and we have a 220. So, you know, charging is pretty fast, but my neighbor who also has one has, you know, has the 120. And so it takes her 8 hours to charge her car. And, you know, I have to wait sometimes just for the weekend just to make it pencil
right.
out.
Right. And further study into time of use might be able to create like more targeted interventions to make time of use rates or standard rates work for you folks or for big industrial customers who are putting a lot of demand on the system. When you look at the program, you see overall satisfaction rates were pretty high, but there were some blind spots. So, for instance, HECO developed a tool to help customers calculate their energy savings if they switch their energy use under time of use rates. And Angela pointed out that a lot of customers said they didn't really understand that tool.
Maybe there's an opportunity to provide greater education around the usage of that tool. I think I shared some of that, how I, you know, went and looked at my own bill and saw what I could do. But it takes a fair amount of knowledge in terms of what you're actually trying to achieve and what does it even mean to shift energy usage from time A to time B and what those intervals are. You have to be a fairly well-informed customer. And that's a challenge to provide that education. And that's true wherever time of use rates have been rolled out.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say that, you know, it does make you think about what you do during the day, you know, whether it's doing laundry, like I said, on the weekend, or another time when it's not so expensive at night.
Right. And time of use is hard to get right. What the Division of Consumer Advocacy is concerned about it is that it might unfairly burden people. But more and more places are adopting time of use around the country. California, for instance, was an early adopter. Their journey has had some speed bumps as well. And I spoke with Mark Tony from TURN, the Utility Reform Network, which advocates for California utility customers. And he says that everyone agrees that peak, which refers to when energy usage is the highest, needs to be reduced. The question is how.
The question is, how do you get there? Do you make it mandatory or do you make it voluntary? There's a lot of successful voluntary peak shaving programs. One is called air conditioner cycling, where customers can voluntarily sign up for a device, remote control device on their air conditioning system. And during times of high peak, the electric company can cycle your air conditioning on 15 minutes, off 15 minutes, on 15 minutes, off 15 minutes. The incentive is $200 a year for the customer. So the customer gets a benefit, but it's voluntary. They get to decide whether to do it. Those are the type of programs in terms of peak shaving that TURN supports.
Interesting.
Yeah, so that's a really targeted approach to reducing energy demand, specifically in the summertime. And California has a similar problem that we have where they have a lot of solar energy, but when there's a lot of demand in the evening, solar can't necessarily account for all of that. And they have a situation where they have what are called peaker plants. So these big gas-fired or oil fossil fuel plants that are designed to run just 100 hours to meet increased peak during the summertime when many people have their air conditioners on. But they cost millions, if not billions of dollars to run. So this little program that reduces energy in these 15-minute intervals can really make a difference to try to keep some of those peaker plants offline and keep those expenses down. There are a lot of options for Hawaii to explore. Right now, Hawaiian Electric is waiting on guidance from the Public Utilities Commission about what next steps might be for a time of use program.
So do you think the PUC will come out with something then later this year?
We'll see. There is an ongoing rate case for Hawaiian Electric, a docket, and the consumer advocate says that's the most appropriate place to have this conversation.
All right. Well, stay tuned. But thank you, Savannah.
Thank you, Catherine.
We've been hearing from HPR's climate and energy reporter, Savannah Harriman-Pote. Look for her stories on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org. Heard of the black wattle tree? Well, it's got a target on its back on Maui because it's fuel for fire in light of the Maui wildfires. Joining us this morning to talk about it is Colleen Oechi with the Hawaii Journalism Initiative. Good morning, Colleen.
Good morning, Catherine.
Yeah, so I'm not familiar with this tree. Describe to our listeners, what does it look like?
Yeah, growing up in Hawaii, I don't think I was really familiar with it either, but it's been in the islands for a long time. Basically, it's called the black wattle, but it looks kind of like a small green Christmas tree, very triangular shape. And it's been in the islands for over a century because people were looking for trees that could be an alternative to the oak for tanning. And so it became profitable and it spread throughout the islands very quickly. So in Kula, it's definitely a problem because it spread a lot. And it was one of the trees that, you know, there was a lot of it that burned in the fire in 2023. And the problem with it is that it's very low, long, and slow burning. And the other issue is that in the areas where it is, it really dominates the environment because it sucks up the moisture in the soil. It's native to Australia, so it's used to dry environments. It takes up all the moisture, makes it tough for other plants to grow around it. And it also puts a chemical in the soil that really discourages other plants. So basically, it doesn't really play well with others, and it pushes out native plants that are already displaced in so many areas of Hawaii.
Well, there's a line in your story that these trees become sponges in the landscape. That's a little scary.
Yeah, the sponges in the landscape, I was talking to the head of the Kula Community Watershed Alliance, and what she was talking about was that they want native trees to go back into the environment because they're like sponges for the water, right? They absorb the water and they put it back into the soil and the environment, and they really, you know, make sure that there's, you know, enough to keep the environment thriving and green. And so that's why they want to get rid of the wattle, because it's taking up the water and it doesn't really put that back into the environment. And they want to put the native plants that are meant to thrive there.
So your story talks about a project then to go in there and eradicate a lot of these trees.
Definitely. So they're really making this push before the summer, which is the hot, dry fire season, right? There's always the risk, but especially in the summer. And so what they're trying to do is they're trying to cut a buffer between homes along this one gulch where the fire burned, and the fire burned some of the homes along the gulch. They're trying to cut back the wattle trees that have really grown back thick and quickly after the 2023 fire. And they just want to make sure it's kind of a twofold thing, right? They want to make sure they reduce the risk of fire, you know, cut back this invasive plant, and they eventually want to come back and plant native plants in the area. So they're really trying to transform this gulch where the fire just, you know, really raced through a couple of years ago. So that's the effort that they're making now ahead of the summer.
And so what can you tell us about these trees? Are they fast growers, slow growers?
Well, they really take up the environment fast, that's for sure. Just looking at this gulch, the entire side of the gulch was lined with green wattle trees. And I thought, wow, it's been less than 2 years since the fire, and already they've really taken over. So they do have a tendency, like many invasive species, to just take over the environment that they're in. And so, yes, very, very quickly since the fire, they've been able to regrow and just repopulate the gulch. And so it's definitely a big task that this group has ahead of them.
And so are these trees very big?
They're pretty big. You know, the ones that have grown so far, they're still young trees. So they're not producing those flowers yet that the experts say that they're worried about, because once they produce the seeds and the flowers, those can last a long time in the soil, and then it's hard to get rid of them. So right now, that's why they're going after the wattle, because they're still young. They're trying to take them down, but they're still quite big trees. You know, I saw them, and I was watching the crew members with this pole saw reaching into the gulch and cutting them down, and they're pretty large. They're, like I said, they're probably the size of a Christmas tree you might have in your home, but they can get even bigger than that because these were still younger trees.
Wow, so it's quite a problem. And like you said, we're getting into wildfire season, so we've got to do what we can to reduce the risk, particularly if they're slow burning, because much more difficult to put out.
Definitely, and that's why it's good to have groups like this, right? Because, you know, after the fire, there was just so many things to think about, so many immediate needs we had to meet. And if you lost your home, you're focusing on that, right? The stress of the insurance and rebuilding. And it's great to have a community group like this that's like, hey, we're going to look out for the environment while our community is recovering. We're going to start chipping away at this. So once people's homes are rebuilt, you know, we're already ahead of the game, planting native trees, you know, growing a nursery and a seed bank, and just making sure that the environment is healing as our community rebuilds too.
Yeah, well, interesting story. Thank you so much, Colleen.
Yeah, thank you, Catherine, for having me.
That was editor Colleen Uwechi. You can check out the Hawaii Journalism Initiative story at MauiNow.com. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. We now go to this week's Manu Minute. Patrick Hart from the University of Hawaii at Hilo brings us a song of the modest Hawaii creeper. This little bird is hard to spot, but today we'll hear its call as well as its rediscovered Hawaiian name.
The alavi, also known as the Hawaii creeper, is a small, fairly inconspicuous Hawaiian honeycreeper that's often been overlooked compared to many of its showier honeycreeper cousins. Even its Hawaiian name of alavi was only recently rediscovered when a graduate student at UH Hilo found reference to it in an old Hawaiian language newspaper from over a century ago. Only about 4.5 inches long, alavi have mostly olive green or grayish plumage that bird watchers often confuse with other birds like female amakihi. What really sets them apart is their dark grayish-colored mask, or lores, that extends from the base of their bill to around their eyes. Also, their bill is much straighter than the slightly curved bill of the amakihi. While they might be hard to find with binoculars, listening for the very conspicuous, descending trill of the males is often the best way to find an alavi. They're also known as creepers because they forage for food by creeping up and down branches and tree trunks, using their straight bill to probe in the crevices of bark in search of insects to eat. They can often be found in the same tree as one of their close cousins, the bright orange Hawaii akepa, which is also an insectivore. While these two birds have similar diets, they share their resources by dividing up where they forage on the tree, with the akepa spending most of their time in the leaves on the tips of branches, and the alavi mostly on the trunk. Alavi usually build cup nests in the branches of ohia trees, and by May or June, their one or two keiki leave the nest. For the next few months, these keiki noisily follow their parents around the forest begging for food as they are learning to better forage for themselves. This constant begging makes them easy targets for their main predator, the eo, or Hawaiian hawk. To help protect their noisy babies, alavi get together in large mixed-species flocks with other native birds in the forest, like akepa, amakihi, and akiapolaau, that are also feeding their fledglings around that time. As many as 200 birds can make up these flocks, which can be quite a sight to see as they slowly move among the trees. With only about 12,000 individuals remaining, alavi are a state and federally listed endangered bird species that is found mainly in ohia and koa forests on the island of Hawaii. Like most other Hawaiian honeycreepers, mosquito-transmitted avian malaria is their greatest threat, which is why they're currently only found at high elevations on Mauna Kea and Mauna Loa volcanoes, where it's too cold for mosquitoes and the malaria parasites to live. For Hawaii Public Radio, this is Patrick Hart from the UH Hilo Department of Biology.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Hawaii Forest and Trail, exploring Hawaii Island with visitors and kama'aina for more than 30 years. More information at hawaii-forest.com.
A Qatari jet, his own cryptocurrency. Is President Donald Trump normalizing corruption?
We've never had a president, at least in the post-Watergate period, who has been so open about his use of the presidency to line his own pockets.
Could it corrode our belief in political integrity at every level? Trump and trickle-down corruption, that's on the next On Point.
Beginning this afternoon at 2.
It's a parent's worst nightmare to lose a child in a mass shooting. It's another if your child was responsible.
How would you like to be the parent of a mass murderer? Try that one. It's horrible.
Can a mother's insights on her son help prevent the next mass shooting?
I hope that my hindsight will be your foresight.
On the next Reveal.
Beginning this evening at 7, following The Daily.
You know, the end of the school year can mean hungry cakey as students lose access to school meals. Data from the Hawaii Food Bank show that one out of every four children will face food insecurity this summer. The Happy Bento is a lunch service program that serves 27 different Oahu campuses throughout the school year. Deanna Cornelius is the company's founder, and she recently reached out to us through our talkback email to share the impact of federal policies on her small business at this critical time for food security. She wrote, "The Happy Bento is getting notices almost weekly about things increasing in price. We hate to raise prices because we know that doing so will only affect families' finances more than they already are." Well, the conversation with C.W. Gibson followed up with Cornelius about efforts to keep Keiki fed through summer programs, even as she faces tariffs and cuts to federal grants.
The Happy Bento was started in 2016 as a response to my children's school asking over and over again for a healthier school lunch. And at the time, I wasn't in the business of making lunches every day. I struggled to make my own children's lunches. And they just kept asking, and finally I said yes as an experiment, and I've been going since 2016. We started at 22 meals a day, and now we do over 900 a day.
Talk about the model, because you're trying to provide not only lunch, but a healthy lunch. And so what goes into that in terms of partners and your approach to making the food?
In Hawaii, there's a huge opportunity, I think, to source locally. And even though oftentimes it's more expensive, if you can do it at scale, it doesn't have to be so much more expensive. And I also think that because I am a nutritionist by training, I know that the earlier and the more often you expose children to healthy foods, even if they go through their teenage years and their 20s, deviating from that and eating only what's found in convenience stores, perhaps, when they're about 30 or when they start their own families, they naturally return to what they were exposed to when they were very young. So that's the proposition I brought to school lunch is let's see how many kids we can expose over and over again to healthy food and see if maybe peer pressure comes into there a little bit. Like, you know, if he's eating broccoli, I can try eating the broccoli and introduce things like brown rice instead of just white and local fruits and vegetables that a lot of kids haven't ever seen before. And besides being nutritious, it can be fun, it can be beautiful, and a healthy diet, especially at school, encourages healthy learning and less sleepiness after lunch.
Yeah, for sure. Strong ties between nutrition and learning and capacity for learning. So now we face some disruptions in the current political climate, including a lot of changes in the federal government in terms of grant allocations. Has any of that touched your business model?
Of course. Yes. So prices in general are going up, prices of ingredients. Because we're an island and we unfortunately still import 85 to 90% of our food, we do get fresh produce from the mainland. or from mainland distributors that come from Mexico, for example. We have some mainland apples, some of our watermelon before it's grown in Hawaii comes from Mexico. Doesn't taste as good, but we like to mix up the fresh fruits and vegetables. And oranges is another thing. So yeah, those imports have costed a lot more recently, as well as the containers that we use and the compostable forks.
You also had some issue with some of the grant money that you had as well. Tell us about what happened with some of the grant money that you had.
Right. So we were so excited last fall to learn that the federal government was incentivizing local farmers to provide more of their whatever they grew for the purposes of school meals. And so we were able to take advantage of some of those grants, and we were getting Okinawan purple sweet potato and ulu or breadfruit and some ground beef from the Big Island. And at the end of this month, that grant money will run out because it has been canceled.
And that was grant money that was coming in some way, shape, or form from the federal government.
Yeah.
The Trump administration is very focused on trying to make sure we're making as many things as we can within the country and supporting business within the country. And it sounds like you just described a model that was doing just that, collaboration with small farms and a small business like yours. And that's what's had the rug pulled out from under it. I mean, I just want to make sure I'm tracking that.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's up to us. Are we going to continue to purchase through these farmers, or is it cost prohibitive? We won't know until probably the middle of the summer, but it's anticipated that we won't be able to continue.
And I know that the work that the Happy Bento does isn't limited to the school year. As we come upon the summer months here, your work continues. So tell us what it looks like in the summer months.
So the summer is almost as busy. We might serve 900 to 950 meals a day during the school year, and it could drop to 500 to 600 during the summer. And because not every school is year-round, there are some summer months in there, June and July mostly, where other programs pop up, summer language programs, or a lot of the preschools are, in fact, year-round. And then summer programs that only operate, you know, during June and July, and we service those. We've been servicing those kinds of programs every year.
There was another grant that you lost that was given through the Child Nutrition Program, and that helped actually, as I understand it, support some of the meals that you provided for children, specifically during the summer or throughout the year?
Throughout the year.
And so will that affect what you're able to do in the coming months and how many meals you're able to provide?
That will. When I first started this business, my goal was not to make a bunch of money. My goal was to expose as many kids as possible to real good food. And as part of that, I decided early on that we were going to provide, you know, X number of free meals every single day to each school and leave it up to the school to determine which kids were on either financial aid or otherwise needed a free lunch every day. And they could count on us to provide those. So we've provided, you know, over 1,000 free meals just in the last school year. And we will continue to do so this summer. But instead of 5 free meals per school, it's going to have to be cut down to 2. So that's one big way, in my opinion, that these increases in costs are starting to affect real children.
And that comes at a time of the year, I know, when food insecurity is heightened for kids that aren't in school regularly. I mean, I know you're providing some of the meals to schools, but you're also doing summer programs and so forth. And so it sounds to me like bad timing.
Right.
We've talked so much the last several weeks in the news cycles, so much about tariffs and how they're affecting small businesses like yours, how cuts to federal programs, federal grants are affecting small businesses like yours. And I know that's front and center as you try to find a path forward. But there are other issues that you face. Paying employees, like retaining employees. Talk about the challenges that are there for you and what you want to provide for those employees.
Right. So the Happy Bento always starts at way above minimum wage for new employees. And we have a profit sharing program. So, you know, the more students we serve, the more of a profit there can be. And so we have a twice a year profit sharing program. I'd also like to increase pay every year if I can. This year, you know, I'm starting to get real nervous because the profit sharing bonuses and pay raises that I had in mind, you know, I have to take a second look at. And I really don't like to do that because without my employees, we couldn't do all of this good work. And they really are what makes the Happy Bento move forward and grow. And they should be able to provide for their families even as prices go up. And so that's first and foremost in my mind when I look at the numbers with my CPA. It's getting really scary right now because I'm not sure what the next 4 months look like in terms of revenue and costs.
How many employees do you have?
10.
Has this come up with any of them yet?
Not yet. I try to be very transparent and let them know what's happening as it's happening. But, you know,
it's a hard conversation.
It is a hard conversation to have. I haven't given myself a raise in 4 years and don't plan to, because I want to make sure that the good people that I have stay with us, because the good work that we're doing is feeding children. And without them, we couldn't do it.
I feel like, again, the grant cuts and tariffs, and it's like this ball of yarn that has all these loose threads that are out there that we don't always think about in terms of salaries for employees, in terms of partnerships with other local entities that are meaningful to the communities in which they work and operate. Are there other considerations that you think sort of get lost in the conversation?
I had a school principal ask me the other day why it is that prices are going up, like the price per lunch. And instead of just, you know, using the generic, oh, the cost of business is going up, I was able to spell out for her every single reason. And those reasons include things that a lot of people don't think about. Like, it costs more money to feed a cow to produce a gallon of milk than it did a year ago. And it costs more money for that carton, the paperboard, that carton is made to carry the milk, you know, and on. And every little thing costs more money. It's hard to think about all the little details that go into a final cost of something. But there are hundreds of costs that go into school lunch, like producing a school lunch, for example. Even though it looks like here's a three-compartment tray with spaghetti and meatballs and purple sweet potato and locally grown corn, for example, but there are a lot of factors that go into it: rent, water, utilities, labor, transportation, et cetera.
Is there anything else about the challenges that the Happy Bento is facing right now that I haven't asked you about?
I'm so grateful that our schools are trusting us to feed their kids. I get up every day and this sounds really cliche, but I'm genuinely excited to go to work and to take pictures of the, you know, the awesome lunches that we're producing, and they're so colorful, and my employees seem genuinely happy to be there. And then when I get a random phone call from a parent wondering, what are we putting in our purple sweet potato mash? Because when she makes it at home, they won't eat it, but, you know, they love it at school. And so when I get a call like that, I just get goosebumps, and I just feel like I'm doing the right thing. I'm doing what I was supposed to do.
That was Deanna Cornelis, founder of the Happy Bento. She spoke with HPR's G.W. Gibson. Are you a small business owner facing your own difficulties because of uncertain tariffs or cuts to federal grants? Drop us a line like Deanna did. Talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. Okay, we're all out of time, but up tomorrow, we plan to take a closer look at a bill on the governor's desk that could lower the cost of prescription drugs for vulnerable patients. Got a story you'd like to share? Leave your feedback on our TalkBack line, 808-792-8217, or email TalkBack at hawaiipublicradio.org. Find The Conversation as a podcast on Spotify, Apple, or on our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.